This is now the lab lecture time of the course. This goes from 11:30 to 12:20. We will be taking a short break today. In fact, each day that there is lab, we will have that short break in between the lab lecture and the lab. What I'd like to do this first hour is to go over the syllabus and go over some of the main sections from that syllabus. Then after we take our break, I'll give you an introduction to lab safety and talk about your first homework assignment, because we do have an experiment that does begin on Thursday, so you'll have a pre-lab that's due on Thursday. And then we'll do the checkout itself. For those of you who are trying to add into the course, you can feel free to stick around all the way up through to the point where we do check-in. But because you are not enrolled in the course, you're not covered by our insurance, and so I cannot actually let you check in and get a locker today. Yes, ma'am. I won't be doing it today because these couple of students that I have contacted me, I want to make sure they are really going to be in the course before I give up their spot. So on Thursday, after I've had a chance to contact them, then I will do the lottery. All right. So let me go ahead and pull up the syllabus. Instead of giving you a long URL to write down, I thought I'd just show you how you can navigate to it. So if you go to the main DeAnza website, and you go to the Faculty Staff tab, on the right-hand side, you can see there's a list here for directories. From that point, if you click on Faculty Websites and go to My Last Name, Gray, and click on David Gray, that'll bring you to my main jump-off page that has a list of the courses that I've taught in the past. So I do have archives of Chem 1, the most recent version of which that I taught, still posted, Chem 50 as well, and in fact, Chem 12B and 12C from last year I've got posted. You obviously want Chem 12A. It's a bit inelegant. I'll need to redesign the website at some point, but since we have three sections of 12A, which is somewhat unusual, I've just put a link here for you to get to the correct page for your class. So if you click on that link, it takes you to an identical looking page, but that is where you can download the syllabus. So if you click on the syllabus button, that brings up the syllabus for this course, which is almost identical to the syllabus for sections 1 and 2, except, of course, we're meeting Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday instead of Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So we have almost the same schedule, except for the fact that, again, Thanksgiving, we will have one Thursday that we're absent, that because the other class does not meet on Thursday, they won't be absent. As far as an introduction to what this course is, we mostly tackled that this morning. I didn't talk much about the lab component, though, so I want to let you know that in terms of lab, the goals for this quarter will be to get into the introductory techniques of organic chemistry. So, for example, our first experiment will be an extraction lab. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about what you need to prepare that when we come back for the second part of this lab session. We also will be learning several pieces of instrumentation. We are somewhat fortunate at DeAnza that we do have the instrumentation that we have, particularly a nuclear magnetic resonance spectrometer, which works on somewhat the same way that an MRI machine does, if you're familiar with MRI. It will be the most complicated of the instrumental techniques that we learn this quarter. So in fact, pretty soon into the quarter, we're going to start almost daily covering that technique at the same time that we're talking about the lab that's going on as well. We will also be covering infrared spectroscopy, which you might have done if you took Chem 1C here, and we'll be covering a gas chromatography as well. As far as how this class is structured, there are the three sections this quarter of Chem 12A, but they're not interchangeable. So if you're signed up for this section, you need to come only to this section. Sections 1 and 2, that is an entirely separate course. And I'll get to in a moment what happens if you are absent for lab. Because we have to limit enrollment to 26, because of the number of fumehood spaces that we have, you can't go to another section to make up normally because they already have 26 people there. So really, everything is going to focus just on this section 3. So you've already been to lecture this morning. That was from 9:30 to 10:20. There's the lab lecture that would be now 11:30 to 12:20, and then lab itself goes from 12:20 to 2:10. As far as grade structure for this course, 75% of your grade is lecture, 25% of your grade is lab. However, you do need to pass the lab in order to pass the course. And you need to complete all of the labs in order to pass the course. As far as the breakdown of grades within lecture, there will be 3 quizzes and 3 midterm exams. Each of the quizzes is worth 33 points, plus one more point thrown in to get that to 100 total. Then there'll be 3 exams for 150 points each. That's 450 more. And then the final exam will be 200 points. So altogether, that's 750. In terms of lab, there are going to be 7 experiments, so we'll have 7 lab reports. They would most likely be much shorter than what you did in Chem 1 series, because there aren't the exhaustive list of calculations that you might have had for previous experiments. So there'll be 7 lab reports, each worth 10 points. At some point in the quarter, I will collect lab notebooks, so there'll be 1 lab book assessment for 20 points, and then there'll be 2 lab exams, 1 during the middle of the quarter, and then 1 the day that we do checkout. Since we have lab and lecture together as 1 course, the final is actually going to be only for the lecture content. So we do not meet during finals for the lab portion. So again, that last day that we do meet for lab, that will be when the second of the lab quizzes occurs. All that adds together for 250 points. So again, a combined total of 1,000, 75% lecture, 25% lab. I do grade on a plus-minus scale, so when you download the syllabus, you can see the breakdown that I have. I do need to point out that in the community college system, there is no such thing as a C-minus, so the lowest grade that's a passing grade is a C. And you do have to get a C or better to move on to Chem 12B. Moving on to registration issues. So the deadline to add this course is Saturday of next week. So again, for those of you on the wait list, if there happen to be any drops between now and then, I will be adding people to the course. After that point, I will not be able to add anyone, so we do hopefully for the waitlist people's sake, if there's going to be a spot that opens up, it hopefully will happen before then. There are several flavors of drop deadlines. So if you are an out-of-state student, if you want to drop and get your refund, you need to do so by this Saturday. If you are an in-state student, you can drop for a refund by next Saturday. And then if you wanted to drop and have no grade record, but by that point you would not be able to get a refund, that would be the Saturday after that, the 15th. Past that point, there is no way to go back and retroactively drop, because as an instructor, I am required, if someone disappears from the course, to drop you during the first 2 weeks. It's one of my responsibilities. After that point, I will purposely not initiate any drops or withdrawals. And let me explain one of the reasons why. There was a student one time who had disappeared from the course. I had dropped her from the course. She wrote back in a panic and said, "Why did you drop me? I need this course for my visa status." So I immediately got her put back into the course, but I learned then that because I don't know what your status might be in this course, and because I may or may not be able to get a hold of you, after the 2-week deadline, if you needed to drop or withdraw, you must initiate that drop or withdrawal. Since you will be initiating it, there's no way for you to break these deadlines. So these deadlines are going to be enforced. I just want to clearly let you know that. I know in the distant past, it used to be that an instructor could even go in practically the last day of class and retroactively drop someone. But we got in trouble with the state for doing that. So I just wanted to warn you, I will be enforcing these deadlines. After we do pass the 15th, after we pass that drop deadline, there is a withdrawal deadline. And let me just clear up a little confusion that I've heard in the past. Unless someone can tell me otherwise, I can't imagine any situation in which an F is preferable to a W. And I say that because I know that many of you may be trying to transfer to Berkeley or San Diego or one of the other UCs, and so you're concerned with what your transcript looks like. But if you have some kind of serious event that occurs, either I had a student once that was in a car accident, if unfortunately a close family member passes away, you're not able to finish the course. That is what the purpose of a W is. So a W doesn't mean you tried to do the course and didn't do well. What it's supposed to mean is you tried to do the course, but something prevented you from finishing the course. Because of that, don't stick in a course to get an F just because you're worried about getting it to me. But if you do drop after that drop deadline, you would get a notation in your transcript that you had taken the course. Until the withdrawal deadline, which is November 18th. After that point, I must assign you a grade. So if something happens and you do need to withdraw from the course, please make sure that you do it before that November 18th deadline. Because again, after that, I must assign you a grade for the course. There's one other deadline I'd like to let you know about, which is the pass, no pass option. So sometimes people will take this course that don't need it necessarily for transfer. They're doing it more out of interest. And so if you wanted to designate it as pass, no pass, if you get a C, B, or A, or C or higher, I should say, then you'd get a pass, and below C, that you would get a fail. As an instructor, I never know who's doing this course as pass or fail. So to me, you would look exactly the same on the roster list. It's just after I submit grades, then that pass-fail designation would be put in. Now, if you did decide to do this pass-fail, but you end up doing really well, and you want to go back and convert it to a grade, you can do so, but only up until October 21st, which is that pass-fail deadline. The reverse is true as well. If you were doing this course more out of interest, but you thought, no, I'll go ahead and take the letter grade, but maybe it doesn't end up being quite the workload you expected, and maybe you're not doing as well as you would like, and so you'd like to convert it into just a pass-fail. Again, after that deadline, you would not be able to go back and convert. So the main message is please be sensitive to these deadlines if something happens that you need to change your status or drop from the course. Any questions about the grade breakdown or these registration deadlines? Okay, so moving on. The first quiz will be on October... that's for the other section. I'm sorry. Forgot to update. Your first quiz will be on October 6th, your first exam will be on the 18th, and your first lab exam will be on November 1st. So I will go back this afternoon and update for this for you. So just add one to each of the dates that's quoted here so far. By this evening, I will correct this error. Once I correct these, you do have the quiz and exam schedule. For those of you who have jobs or other classes that you're taking, one change that I'm making from previous quarters is that unless it really truly is an extreme circumstance, or unless you warn me now at the beginning of the quarter, I will not be giving makeup exams. What I do instead is that, you know, there's always the chance that you're going to have a bad day in the exam, but otherwise you're a good student. And so what I've typically done in the past is that at the end of the quarter, if percentage-wise, if your final is a higher percentage than your lowest test grade, then I'll replace that lowest test grade with your final. So if you do happen to do poorly on one assessment, but you recover by the end of the quarter, then you get some credit back for that. Now, it doesn't work the other direction. If you're doing really well, but don't do quite as well in the final, I will not take that low final grade and substitute it for one of your lecture exams. But this also covers what would happen if you were to miss an exam, so that your final grade in that case would substitute for that missing exam. Now, if it is some extreme circumstance, you have a parent that passes away, you're stuck in a hospital and you can't do anything about it, then I can accommodate. But just run-of-the-mill illnesses, the problem I've had in the past is that the night before an exam, all of a sudden I get 5-6 students that magically have come down ill that evening. And not that it can't happen, but I personally somewhat doubt that that always happens given how many times that tends to happen. So that's why I no longer do makeup exams. As far as the types of assignments that we will have, I don't assign homework. As you'll see on the syllabus, I have a list of example problems that I recommend that you work. The way that this textbook is structured, there's text and then a series of small problems. I recommend you work all of those in-chapter problems for the sections I have assigned, but then I have selected some other problems for you to do. I don't collect homework, but I really, really strongly encourage you to do homework, because it's not really good enough just to know something in this course. You've got to be able to apply it. So in other words, you're not just accumulating knowledge, you're also going to be accumulating a set of skills. As far as the quizzes and exams, quizzes will be 20 to 25 minutes in length generally. They won't be quite as intense as the exams in terms of difficulty of problems. There's really going to be more of a spot check to see if you are studying and if you're studying the right types of things. The exams are more comprehensive. They will last the entire period of lecture. Both the quizzes and exams will be given in lecture at the 9:30 class. So we'll be actually back here, but at 9:30. Quizzes and exams are not explicitly cumulative. Now, OChem, even more than Chem 1, though, builds from the beginning all the way through to the end. So although I will not ask you explicitly questions about Exam 1, when you take Exam 2, you need to know the material from Exam 1 to be able to handle Exam 2. But exams are not therefore explicitly cumulative one to the next. However, the final exam is cumulative for the course. So don't forget everything that you learn now, because you're going to need it again once you get to the end of the course. In terms of format of exams, particularly for those of you who are ESL students, I want to let you know that there are no multiple choice exams in the class. And the reason I've chosen not to do those is I prefer to have a chance to give partial credit. And so by giving a fill-in type of answer, if you know something but can't quite remember that one little detail, at least you can explain what you do know and I can give you the credit for that. And so I can better see what your thinking process is, and I just prefer to give that style of exam. So particularly on the first exam, it'll be heavily fill-in-the-blank concept type questions. As we do start to learn more about mechanism and synthesis, then we'll have, for example, that fill-in-the-blank type of problem I mentioned. We'll have synthesis problems, mechanism problems, and as we learn new material, I'll also present new types of problems that I'll be asking you on these various types of assessments. Now, the lecture schedule itself, these dates are correct, and these are the section numbers we will be following. As I might have mentioned this morning, we will be jumping around a little bit. Particularly in Chapter 1, the entire discussion of acid-base chemistry we're going to skip over for now until we have a chance to talk about equilibrium. Because we want to talk about dissociation constants, it really doesn't make sense to do it until we've had a review of equilibrium. So we will be in Chapter 1 for the rest of this week and beginning of next week, but we're going to be focusing on atomic and molecular structure. Then from there, nomenclature, functional groups, stereochemistry, some of those topics I mentioned this morning. Then we'll come to mechanism, thermodynamics, equilibrium, and then we'll get into OChem proper, you could say. Again, next to each of these topics are the problem numbers I've suggested. For some of the topics, there aren't any additional problems that I found I thought were worthwhile to do. But if you want any kind of supplement, oh, in fact, I forgot to mention about textbooks in general. This is based off of the official textbook, which is the 6th edition of Bruce. How many of you already have the 6th edition of Bruce? How many of you are using a previous edition of the text? How many of you are using an entirely different text altogether? How many of you have not even bought the text yet? Okay, so if you're going to purchase a text and you have no organic text, I would recommend the newest edition. I have not compared it exhaustively to the previous edition because we did not use this text in the past. We used a text from a different author. I do know there are other texts that are quite popular, particularly one by McMurray. McMurray is known to be very readable, but unfortunately, since 90% of the organic textbook market is for pre-meds, that book has been watered down a bit in terms of detail and difficulty over the time, because it's really being geared more towards the pre-med OChem market. So if you get an older edition of McMurray, it's still quite good. If you wanted something even more challenging than our current textbook, I could make recommendations like that as well. How many of you in here are chemistry majors? Okay, so you might be interested in one of those alternates. How many are biology or molecular cell biology, some flavor of biology? What about engineering, civil, mechanical, electrical, and what about medical, including pharmacy, optometry?
what the benefit couch really shrugs. So it's the best. Okay.
So though the my chem major, you might be interested in one of those texts if you end up liking organic chemistry. So for any of you that want to use an alternate text, I would just request that maybe you wave it in front of me to let me know what you're using. The only difficulty with using an alternate text is the page numbers and section numbers, of course, are not going to match. And Bruce does take a different philosophy of presenting these topics than other textbooks do. So you'll have quite a bit of flipping around. But the last class of OChem I taught, they all had their textbooks they liked. They function well. So since I don't collect homework, since I don't make you turn in things directly related to the text, you really are free to use whatever text that you'd like to. Now, the lecture, the lab text, however, you do need to get at least the text by the same authors, Gilbert and Martin. And we are using the most current edition of the text. However, I've been told by one of the other instructors that it is largely identical to the previous edition. So if you've purchased the previous edition of the Gilbert and Martin, the only difficulty you're probably going to have is the page numbers are very slightly different. But these are the page numbers that are reflective of the current edition. First experiment is kind of in the middle of the text. It is an acid-base extraction. I'll explain more about this theory versus procedure distinction I make. This has to do with the way that we're going to be doing pre-lab for the quarter. And there's also certain techniques that have nothing, they're not directly part of these experiments. In fact, they're techniques that will be used in many of the experiments. But just so you don't get too hit with too much information at once, I recommend a few of them each session for you to read, just to be familiar with technique-wise what you're going to be doing in the lab. Any questions up to this point on the syllabus? Yes?
How do people test for this lab?
You're going to need the lab text today because you're going to need to start homework from it today. You do not have to bring it on Thursday, but there is a pre-lab you're going to need to prepare. Now, yesterday I did walk a copy of the lab text to the library, so if you don't have it yet, if you've got it on order and it's not in, it is available on reserve for 2 hours. So anyone that might need it for a brief period of time, we do have it in the library available. And in fact, I might have an extra copy even that I'll bring over there just in case. But you don't have to have your lab text in lab. In fact, I won't let you use your lab text in lab. Because when I explain pre-lab, I'll explain why. The question was asked by someone earlier, should I bring my lecture text to class? If you feel like hefting it around, sure. But again, you don't have to have the lecture text. I will occasionally refer to maybe diagrams that are in that text, but I do have the display podium up here, so I could always throw my copy up to show you if you didn't have to have yours available. Any other questions up to this point? All right, so much of the rest, the middle part of this syllabus, you may end up skipping because it's a bit more about philosophy. I talk about the way that I'd like for lecture to go. I know that very few of you know who I am yet. I know very few of you. But as we get more familiar with each other, instead of me doing what I'm doing now, which is sitting up and talking the entire time, I'd love to have even more back and forth questions. So there's a section here where I talk about that. There is a section where I talk about expectations, learning philosophy, teaching philosophy. Since we're very low on time for today, let me summarize it this way. I've taught OChem a few times now. I've taught General Chem even more times. And in those courses, I've seen what's going to happen at the beginning of the quarter. I know where the topics tend to be more difficult, tend to be less difficult. I know, for example, in this course, I'm guessing that you all are going to get an 80-something percent average on the first exam, at least if you follow the last few years in terms of patterns. If you follow the last few years, you will then get a 60 or 70% average on your second exam and third exam. Because we do start out much more in the Chem 1 land, review of material. And so because it's review, students tend to do much better. As we start getting into OChem and your familiarity drops, unless you've got good study habits in place, then the grades start to drop. Because not only do you move into new material, but that material becomes at you more and more and more rapidly. By the time you get to Chem 12B, you'll be learning multiple reactions a day, and for each of those reactions, you have to know mechanism and all the different consequences of that reaction that the mechanism causes. So, I know the beginning of OChem, I know what's going to happen in the middle of OChem, and I know what's going to happen at the end of OChem. Now, I could do whatever I could to teach. I am a little bit old-fashioned, so as you can tell, I like to teach writing it down, because I personally believe that the act of writing it down and being immersed in that material is one way to better absorb that material. Now, of course, each of you has got different learning styles, and I do speak to that in here. And if you haven't ever figured this out before, it would be in your best interest to figure, are you a more visual learner? If someone writes it and you see it once, do you have it stuck in your head? If you're hearing it, is that what makes you learn it? If you do problems and you repeat something, are you a mechanical learner? So, no matter what I do up here, though, none of it matters unless you do the work. So my part's the easy part, the 5% of the work. I just get up here and show you what chemistry is. But then you've got to put your own effort into the course. So, for example, when I come to class on Thursday and I ask how many of you read the sections that I put in the syllabus before class, usually, for past classes, nearly every class, it's half the class or less. And as the quarter goes on, it tends to drop off. Even the day before the exam, if I ask that question, only half the people will raise their hand. It should not be a surprise, then, what the distribution of grades ends up being. And I know that because this is my 12th year now here, every quarter I say this. Every quarter I get up on my soapbox and say, you need to do this. And every quarter, some people do and some people don't. And that's what I mean by your effort. If you're the type of person that reads before class, ESL students, I know what it's like to operate in another language because I've had to write philosophy papers in another language. And so if you're trying to do something like that and you're not proficient yet, you're reading two or three words along and then you get stuck on the one word and you got to go look it up and you get two or three words further and you got to stop again and look that up and go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Which is all the more reason why you should read before you come to class, because even if you don't understand it all, then when I get them to speak about it and we get across these vocabulary terms, you'd be much more able to handle it. Even for native English speakers, chemistry is its own language. And so being exposed ahead of time makes, I feel, the lecture that much more beneficial to you. If you are the iPod generation that just comes in and sits and just watches me up here and doesn't interact and doesn't do a thing, you're not getting as much as you could out of the course. So again, I can say, here's today, and again, all the topics, I know what's coming, but what are you going to do? That's a nutshell of what I got in this part of the facilities. One thing I need to talk about in that other portion of the syllabus, oh wait, I addressed it already, that's right, that we won't actually have makeup exams and such. Course. So, any questions? I must finally have the caffeine hit because I did that in much less time than I expected. Actually, because it took us much less time to do roll than the other sections did. Since we're not quite to break time yet, let's go ahead and just start the safety introduction then, and then we'll have our break. Let's start with yes.
What about Ohio?
But I couldn't quite hear you. What did you need to know about? So lab reports will be to do two lab sessions after you finish an experiment. But our first experiment is going to be four labs long. So your first lab report is not even going to be due for 3 or 4 weeks. I'm purposely not talking about it today because at least in the other classes, we didn't even have time to talk about it. I'd kind of like to get into an experiment and so that you have something concrete for me to talk about how you should write it up instead of just talking in the abstract. Now, if you download the syllabus, though, it does give you guidelines for how to write the lab reports. And I will certainly explain that in gory detail once we are ready to actually write a lab report. Yes.
And all the body lecture, is it in here or is it in the other room?
All the lectures will be in this room. Oh. So the G6 building, that's for
all
the... For Friday, that's for sections 1 and 2. For section 3, we're always going to be here.
Oh.
So those they really are two completely distinct courses, the 1-2 section and the 3rd section. So Friday will be here.
Yeah.
You may be wondering, because normally we don't run labs on Fridays, but because of the space issues that we have across campus, we're short several classrooms, so it's hard for us to get space. And this course got created very last moment. So we will be using this lab room on Friday when no one else is around. Now, about personal lab safety, what I'm getting at is appropriate lab attire. Now, don't dress like I am. No, because don't bring your Gucci, your Armani, your bling, because you're going to get it ruined in here. Any of you who have been through Chem 1 and used silver nitrate, you know what silver nitrate does to skin and clothing. And we got other things like that that we're going to be using that are corrosive in this this class. In fact, when I was in grad school, I learned the hard way about attire, because very soon after I started grad school, I kept getting holes all at about the same level of my legs, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. Until one day I happened to be talking to someone, I was leaning up against the bench, and I looked down and realized the bench was exactly the same level as the holes that I was getting in my jeans. So don't wear your good clothes to lab. Have a backup set of clothes. As you can tell, it feels a little warmish, a little stuffy-ish in here. We're probably going to maybe escape some of the big heat that we've had other years. But because it might get warm, while we're in lecture and while we're in lab lecture, I don't actually mind if you're in shorts or not, because we don't have chemicals out at that point. So I would recommend bringing a pair of sweatpants or something that you could change into just when you have to be in lab. Having that backup set of clothes is good, so in case you had some major spill and you couldn't stay in your clothes, that you didn't have to go running around in the lab coat the rest of the day, as has happened to one of my lab mates back at Berkeley. He was working with something, got literally all over him, no backup clothes, so it was just... As far as types of clothing, though, it must be pants, skirt, whatever that goes down to the ankle. Why? Because things fall down. And so if you spill a chemical, it's more likely to end up on your legs or something. Shoes. I used to say open toe. No open shoes, period. And what I mean by that is the shoes I'm wearing, I have a hole that I could get my foot into the shoe, but otherwise there are no other types of holes there. I had to sort of broaden my definition because we have things like Crocs now, you know, that are quasi-clothes, but they've got holes in some places. So those aren't acceptable. Sandals with socks are not acceptable. It has to be a full shoe like this. Even the monkey feet, the one with the individual toes, that would be more acceptable than something like Crocs at the moment. All right? So, pants, skirt, whatever, must go down to the ankles, and then closed-toe shoes. Those are the two requirements that we have. For recommendations, up top, of course, the more skin you show, the more skin that can get damaged, the more exposure to chemicals that you're going to have. So I'm not going to tell you to wear long-sleeve shirts, but I would just say that you might want to consider a lab coat, especially for those of you who are science majors and you're going to be in labs for several more years still. But there are no restrictions as far as, like, you must have a lab coat. Gloves. We check out a couple of pair of gloves for free, and then after that we won't let you check them out here. I would recommend for some of you, you might want to consider getting them, because again, drastically reduces your chemical exposure. Now, if you do happen to show up in without appropriate pants, skirt, whatever, and if you do show up in appropriate shoes, I will have to send you home to change before you can begin lab. And I know there might be some other instructors that aren't quite as strict about that, but I would be doing a disservice to y'all to not make sure that you're safe in lab. Accidents do happen, spills will occur, and so you have to show up in appropriate attire. Now, there's one other piece of safety equipment, though, that you must have, which is goggles, of course. Every chem instructor's got horror stories about goggles they can tell. When I was at Rice, that's where I did my undergraduate work, there was an instructor there that did have an eye missing due to a chemical accident. When I was in graduate school, one of the workers down the hallway from me, I wasn't there at the time, but she was working with something that was a known hazard, and she took all the safety precautions. The whole setup blew up while she was there. She ended up being fine, but she had glass embedded all the way through her safety goggles. So if she didn't have those safety goggles on, she'd be blind now. Not to scare you all, because yes, this is Chem 12. No, this is not Chem 1. The chemicals you use here are significantly more harmful, particularly as we get to Chem 12B and to Chem 12C. But it's not likely that you're going to have something blow up in this lab. They're more harmful, but they're not that dangerous. I mean, we do have some sense of what to let college students play with in here. But because we do have hazardous chemicals, you've always got to have goggles on. So the minute that anybody opens up their lab equipment, the goggles go on. Until you leave the room, you've got those goggles on, unless everybody's got their equipment away. So, for example, if you have a friend that you're waiting on to finish their experiment and you want to just sit and work on your homework or something, no problem, but you got to sit there and do it with your goggles on. All right? If you don't have goggles today, we do have goggles that you can check out, and you will need them today because it isn't just the chemicals that's the hazard, it's the glassware itself. For example, we have this glassware that's sitting on the bench back here. If something happens and someone were to brush some of that off and it crashes on the floor, it is perfectly possible that some little shard of glass could pop up and get someone in the eye. So, and glassware doesn't know that you're done with an experiment. Like, usually when I tell people to put their goggles on, the most common excuse is, oh, I'm just waiting for my friend. Well, chemicals don't know that. Glassware doesn't know that. So as long as you're in the lab environment, you must have your goggles on, whether you're in this room, the instrument room, the balance room, or out in the stock room getting something. Now, if you don't have goggles, unlike the past, we do have this common set that's just here that you can put your name on for a sign-up list for. But we haven't sanitized these goggles. They're just an emergency backup pair. So you really should get your own pair of goggles. If you do, the one restriction that we have, well, two restrictions. Make sure that they are actually chemical safety goggles and not just for mechanical work. There can be different types of glass. So if you go to Home Depot or something like that, just make sure that you get something that's appropriate for a chemistry lab. The other requirement is that the goggles must have some form of side shield so we can prevent splashes that might come in from the side, bits of glass that come in from the side. If you put a little effort into it, you'll find that there's all kinds of safety goggles. Humans like to accessorize, so you can find safety goggles that are mirrored, that look like sunglasses, that have leopard print rims. I mean, you can get anything that you want to, but get yourself a pair of goggles. So, closed shoes, appropriate length clothing, and goggles. Those are the things that you must have on Thursday. Now, a couple of other personal related issues. All of the water bottles I've seen you all drinking from, you must have forgotten the fact that you're in a lab. Now, I know that lecture's going on, but because you're in a lab environment, there cannot be any food or drink in here whatsoever. And it's not that I think magically the chemicals are going to hop into the food. No, it's this. You're working with the chemicals, you get it on your hands. You touch your food, you get the chemicals on the food that way, so that when you ingest it, you're having much more direct exposure. Same thing with water bottles. You say, oh, I'll remember, I won't touch that part of the bottle. Right. At some point you're going to forget, you're going to touch the top, you're going to get chemicals on it, you're going to drink, and you're going to expose yourself to chemicals that way. Now, there are areas out here, there's a little cart out here, I even used it myself for the donuts I put out there. I encourage you to leave it out there, and I know it's kind of an honor system, but you know, people don't like when their stuff disappears, so in general they don't tend to take other people's stuff. So usually it works if you wanted to set your drinks or food or whatever out here, you can. If you've got some kind of dietary restriction where you must have food at particular times during the day, let me know and we can accommodate you and find some other even better place to put your food so we make sure that you have it. Just don't consume it here in the lab. I know that people like to hydrate. I do believe in that, but can't do it here in the lab environment. Similarly, bad idea to put cosmetics on for exactly the same reason. You're going to put your hands on chemicals, and then if you're messing with lipstick or whatever, more chance for exposure. Two other safety-related things, but these are of a personal nature, so this is entirely optional, because I cannot request from you personal information. Women, if you are or think that you are going to be pregnant, this may not be the class for you. I'm not a medical doctor, so I can't make that determination, but what I can do is give you a list of chemicals, and I have had students in the past that have gone, and one student in the past, the doctor cleared her for Chem 12A, but not for the other courses in the sequence. Because we're using organics in this class, it is much of a greater concern. And so you don't even have to disclose to me if you don't want to. You can even look through the experiments that are listed and from that get the list of chemicals if you don't want me to know. But if you end up in that situation, do yourself and your child a favor and go consult with your doctor first before you stay in this course. Another thing along that lines, if you have a pre-existing medical condition that to benefit you, you want me to know about, let me explain a situation that happened to me in grad school. There was a co-worker that had epilepsy. No reason why she needed to tell us, it's her own business. But she had changed medications and she did have an attack in lab one day. Because we were in a research environment, our first thought wasn't, oh dear, what's wrong with her? It was, oh dear, what was she working with? We didn't know if it was medical or chemical related. Turned out to be medical, turned out she was fine. But now imagine my situation being responsible for your safety. If we have like one quarter, someone had narcolepsy, so she just fell asleep. Didn't hurt herself, woke back up at some point, was kind of confused why we were worried. But, and it's entirely her own business. But just on a human level, if you know that I might be able to help you by knowing this kind of thing, then only in that case, if you feel comfortable doing so, I just ask that you consider letting me know. Again, just so that I can make that call or leave you totally alone. I know just to tell everybody, just back off, for example. So we had already gotten through the personal safety aspect. Let's talk a little bit about the lab environment now. So over here first, safety shower, which I'm not going to demonstrate for two reasons. One, not besides the fact that I don't want to get wet, but if you know anything about plumbing and the size of this pipe that's here, you know that there's an awful lot of water that's going to come out of here if I did turn this on. But you may also notice, or maybe you can't see from where you're sitting, but there's no drain for this. And that's because we don't want chemicals to get into the environment, so we purposely don't put a drain in these kinds of showers. But if somehow you get a huge amount of something on you, you may need to come over here and just pull this hander down and you'll get deluged. Now, this is why I recommend that you have that backup set of clothes just in case, so that after you wash the chemicals off, you need something to change into. So, And one other safety shower went to the back of the classroom. To date, we haven't had to use those in this class. However, the eyewash stations, we have. So up here, this type, you just press on the flat part, a lot of water come out. 15 minutes of rinsing is what you need. Because an eye is such a sensitive organ, you've got to make sure that you get everything out washed out of your eye. There's this main eye wash station at the front. There's the other eye wash station that's in the back of the classroom. Now I'll do it airline style. We've got the two up here. We've got the two back there that are eye wash stations. These, you just grip the handle, squeeze, and you'll also get it washed out. The only reason I had to use these so far is not because people were wearing their goggles, but because they're not thinking exactly what they're doing in lab. So they're working, and do this. Rub your eye, which means you just rub the chemicals you're avoiding into your eye. So you do have to be a little bit aware of what's going on while you're in lab. But if you do that, we do have these eye wash stations that are available. Let's see. Over here, this is not directly a safety issue. Well, it is in a sense. More about proper chemical handling and storage. So several of our experiments all use the same types of acids and bases, and so rather than put them out and take them away from each of the different experiments, we've just made this cart where they sit. But you notice that all the different bottles are in these other containers. This is known as secondary containment. This is so bad, particularly in the case of the glass bottles. If they were to break, there's something there to catch that chemical so it doesn't spill and start reacting with other things. But since this is supposed to be a safety feature,
you have to properly segregate different chemicals from each other. So the different types of acids we actually have in different containers, and they're separate completely from the different bases. And you'll find that all liquid chemicals that we have stored all should be in secondary containers. So as you do your experiments, please try not to be totally on autopilot. Don't just take bottles and put them back at random, but make sure that you do get them back to their proper home so we can maintain that proper secondary containment. Chemicals for your experiments will be put out in this booklet, and I'll talk more about handling the chemicals when we begin our first lab. Fire alarms. We have one fire alarm at this door. We have one fire alarm at that door. I almost had to pull one once because the air conditioning system of the building failed and dumped Freon, which turned out not to be harmful at all. It just looked like smoke was coming into the building. So right at the point where we really could tell it looked like that was just reaching for it when it went off by itself. I have had two fires in OCAM, so I'll talk about that when we get to the fire extinguisher over there. Point out the safety shower, the eye wash station. First aid, if you have small cuts or scrapes or something like that, we do have the first aid kit that's in the stock room. If you are more seriously injured, if you're not feeling well for some reason, and this does happen commonly and not for any super bad reason, but some people are sensitive even just to the smells of certain chemicals. So at any point you do feel faint, let me know first before you disappear. So when you disappear, I'm not worried about you. But just let me know that you need to step out and get some fresh air. But if something happens to you or you are feeling more distressed, we do have the health center that's on campus. And if they determine that you need more help, then they'll call whatever medical services they need to. Fire extinguisher. Anybody ever had to use a real fire extinguisher before? Anybody know what not to do with a fire extinguisher? Like if a fire were to happen right now, the way you get this off here is just to pull these tabs to get it off the wall. I won't demonstrate it because then we have to write down why we had to pull the tab, but you yank this tab here out of the handle that keeps the handle from closing, so just pull that pin out, and then you can use the fire extinguisher. Except you should not just aim it at the fire and squeeze. Why not? Possibly, because if you have this little itty bitty piece of glassware that's really lightweight, if you've got any heft behind this at all, it's going to blow that glassware across the room and catch something else on fire. So you start up above the fire and come down to it as you judge just how strong your fire extinguisher is. Now you should know that there is more than one type of fire extinguisher. This is the ABC type, which is generally used for this kind of lab, but would be entirely inappropriate for a metal fire. So, for example, if you have sodium that catches on fire, sodium reacts with water. So you wouldn't want to use anything water-based to put out a sodium fire. But we won't be using anything in here that requires that alternate fire extinguisher, so should any fire happen, this would be the thing to use. Glass, broken glass, we have a separate trash can for that up at the front. So when we get to the point of checking in your lab equipment, if you have anything that's broken, please go ahead and any glassware, I should say, that's broken, please dispose it in this trash can. Do not use the regular trash cans for that glass, only so that when someone comes in to change these trash bags, they don't get unexpected things stuck in their hands because there shouldn't be glass in those containers. Evacuation. We have two true exits from the classroom. The one over here on your left, that is probably the best exit because not so many people are going to be coming that direction, and there is a staircase that's right over here to the right. So probably going to be less congested getting out of the building. We do have the more obvious exit that goes out to the ugly staircase over there. That's where everybody in the panic is probably going to evacuate, though. So if this one is too crowded, only then would I recommend this one. We do also have this door, which is not truly an exit, but if you go across the hallway here, there is another door that goes back out back, and I believe that that walkway doesn't actually connect over to the other side of the building, so it could only be these two labs that would try to escape out that door. So you can go through that door, and there's a staircase that goes down to your left. The room over there, that is the balance room.
That is not an exit. That has a key-locked door. We have to keep our balances under lock and key because they're quite good. So I guess in the spirit of Breaking Bad, people know those are good balances, and they'll walk off if we don't protect them. Then this door over here is also not an exit door. That is to our instrument room. So don't go to either of the solid doors. Go only to the glass doors. Although, how many of you have been in an earthquake? I've been in one standing right here. It was a very mild one, though, but it was enough to make us stop for a moment and figure out, do we need to evacuate or not? And then there was the aftershock that happened right after it when I was lecturing like this, and I turned around, and they were all looking like this. I was like, what did I do, right? And they said, didn't you feel the earthquake? What earthquake? But if we had a major earthquake, why would you not want to go running out the doors, besides the fact that people are panicking and all that? If we're in the older buildings with these tiles on the roof, there certainly could be things falling. So you don't want to go running out of the building and get hit that way. These doors have glass in them. And it may be tempered glass, it may be architectural glass, but glass is glass and eventually, with enough force, can break. So don't go running to the glass windows while things are shaking. These lab benches are really solid. I won't bet money on it, but I bet you that if the roof fell, these things would survive if everything else gets crushed. So I would recommend you crawl underneath of these, because this is pretty good stability right here. Then, once the shaking stops, exit the building. Do not go to the parking lot, because that incident that happened with the air conditioning system, when people did evacuate, they all went down there and stood in the parking lot, and so that the fire trucks had to weave their way through the people to get to what could have been the burning down building. So our official designated place to gather is actually back this way, back at the track and field, which is why I recommended that door as our exit to get us over to that track and field area. Let's see, any other major room-related safety items? Any others that come up, well, probably come up in the context of handling chemicals, which I'll go through when we go through our first lab. But why don't we go ahead and discuss what you need to prepare for your first lab experiment. So the first lab I did mention earlier gave you the page numbers for. When you do go and look at your lab procedures, you'll see there's actually two different flavors for most experiments, a mini-scale procedure and a microscale procedure. So the mini-scale procedure, or microscale, is sometimes preferred because you use less chemicals, so it's a bit more environmentally friendly, a bit less costly, but not always... doesn't always match what you do in real life, because yes, there might be some laboratories in which you are working with microscopic quantities, but we also have engineering firms that generate gallons and gallons of stuff. So we've made a compromise and moved to the mini-scale procedures. So the page numbers I gave you, in fact, are for that correct mini-scale procedure to reduce your workload for this first day of preparation. You only need to do part A for Thursday. We will do the entire experiment, but you only need to worry about part A for Thursday. Now, lab books. A question came up about what type of lab books. Could I borrow that? Not that one, actually. Yes, that will work. This is what I mean by a lab book. You do not have to buy leather-bound, acid-free pages. You're not inventing anything here. You are just taking a chemistry class. But I would want you to have a lab book that has no removable pages. So if it's got perforations, that won't work, and spiral-bound notebooks, that won't work either. It needs to be something like this that's bound and the pages don't come out. Just so we're mimicking, if not fully, the type of book that you would need to use in a research environment. If you have a lab book from Chem 1 and you want to be conservant, I don't mind if you continue to use the same lab book. I would prefer that you staple or clamp or somehow otherwise bind up your Chem 1A portion so I can more easily get to your experiments, but I like not wasting paper. So if you wanted to reuse your Chem 1 lab book, you can feel free to. The very first thing you should put in these lab books is your name and either my name or the class that you're in or something, because one or more of you are going to leave these behind somewhere, some point. So have that identifying information so this can get back to you, hopefully, at some point. Beyond that, when you read the syllabus, you're going to see that I have a lot more to say about lab notebooks than what I'm going to tell you today. Ignore all of that until we get later into the course. As we get ease ourselves into lab, then some of these other requirements that I may put on later, we'll get to those. For this first experiment, just leave this whole first page front and back blank and go ahead and begin your first experiment on that next page. You will need that lab book because you'll need to have your pre-lab on the first day. Now, let me give you the reasons that I want you to do a pre-lab. And also, let me tell you a little bit about the theory versus procedure portion of these experiments that you're going to read. So the way I do lab reports is possibly different than some of your past instructors, because I know what a lot of the faculty here do is to have you write up all the standard things like purpose, procedure, data, calculations, conclusion, and then some form of theoretical discussion where you talk about the lab and to show your instructor that you knew what happened in that experiment. I take that discussion portion of it and put it into the lab quizzes. And so for pre-lab, similarly for pre-lab, we will discuss the theory here in class, but you don't need to write any of the theory out as part of your pre-lab assignment. But don't fall into the trap that I've seen every quarter I've taught here, which is the following. I'll tell you that if you don't have a pre-lab completed for experiment, you can sit for the theory portion, the lab lecture portion, but then you will be sent home for not having your pre-lab, and you'll get a zero on your experiment. When I inform people of this, people get worried, oh, I better have that pre-lab done, or he's going to kick me out of class. But since I don't have that same policy about the theory part, what happens, and I was a student once, I can understand you're busy, you've got so many things you're worrying about, you say, okay, I'll just read that some other time then. I'll get ready for lab at least. And then the next lab, you do the same thing. Oh, I'll read that later. I'll prepare for lab. Then the day before the lab exam comes around, there's this collective, oh, crap, we didn't study for lab quiz. And the lab quizzes, to be honest, are not anywhere near as difficult as the exams. It really is material straight from lecture. I'll even tell you what some of the questions are sometimes. But what happens particularly in Chem 1A, people do well on their lab reports, and then their lab grade stinks because they bomb the lab quizzes. And again, not because of the difficulty factor, but because people didn't study the theory part, because I didn't sit on them and say, I'll kick you out if you don't do it. When I say theory, we're going to do extraction for this first experiment. So we're going to talk about acids and bases, not at a hugely technical pKa level, but just how you can change polarity by doing an acid-base reaction. That's the huge concept that's in that lab, and that will be one of the questions on the lab quiz, where I ask you, how could you separate these two or three compounds by a series of extractions? So if you come in Thursday and I'm starting a lecture on this, unless you're defaulting to the notes I'll be posting, if I see you sitting there doing this and not writing anything, I'm going to say to myself, that's a person that's just on the road to hurt when it comes time for the lab quiz. So again, even though I don't require you to do the theory for your pre-lab, don't put it off to the middle of the quarter. OChem, the workload piles up like this, so whatever you can do at the beginning to stay ahead of that curve, the better. Now, again, back to why are we doing these pre-labs then? Okay, here are the four reasons. The number one is safety. There was an experiment one quarter, not this last year's class, some other class, where the experiment says in big bold at some point, do not mix these two chemicals together because if you do, you'll produce a lacrimer. It's a little more detailed than that, but that's what it says. A lacrimer is a compound that if you breathe it in, you can't breathe because it's so irritating it causes you to choke. Temporarily, possibly, unless it's a nasty one, and then you're in trouble. And have you ever worked with the big, huge chlorine tablets they used to use at pools? And if you open up and you get too close to that, when you open that lid, you just, that's a lacrimer. So this experiment, you have the potential of making a lacrimer if you didn't see that safety note. So I went through my whole pre-lab spiel, got done, and I said, oh, by the way, how many of you have read that note about the lacrimer? And some people kind of look around like this, and then half the class raised their hands. And so the half the class that didn't raise their hands, I turned and asked, do you care that little about your own personal safety that you couldn't be bothered to read that note? This is not Chem 1. This is Chem 12. The chemicals are more hazardous. You're doing the pre-lab not just to see the procedure, but to see these safety notes. That as an instructor, I will be making sure that I tell you. But you should have your own sense of the fact that you are in a chem lab and should therefore hopefully be compelled to read these notes so that you are keeping yourself safe. So that's number one reason for the pre-lab, to keep yourself safe. Number two reason, indirectly, is to keep other people safe. Because I'm sure you've been in a class where something like this has happened. Wait, what was the amount that you're supposed to do for step one? Wait, was that a beaker or an Erlenmeyer? Wait, what do you do with that solution? Which layer is the water or the organic? Is this blue? And just goes on and on and on through the whole class. Which is annoying, but also means that there's a safety hazard. If you didn't do your own pre-lab and you're dependent on something else, that means back to what I said earlier, you don't know about the safety warnings. And you're interrupting everybody else, distracting them, and that's the potential for something else to go wrong, besides the fact that it just gets annoying for people. Third reason, you're supposed to be learning something. Now, I remember asking, and I think we had the one chem major here, and then we had a sprinkling of other disciplines. That means you all are not necessarily here because of your undying passion for chemistry. You're taking this because you have to. But if you're here, why waste your time? Why not get something out of it that you might use in your biology or whatever classes? So if you've read the procedure ahead of time and the theory, then you'll be better able to take what I'm presenting in lecture and learn something from it. If none of those get to you, then what about reason number four, which is you finish, you're done, you go home. So if you're so organized, you can walk in and in 30 minutes you get your lab done and everybody else is still getting their glassware out, you're done. Go home. It's an efficiency thing. An employed chemist is one that's able to set up an experiment, let it go, set up another experiment, knowing that 2 hours from now you've got to go back and check that first one. And after you get those two done, you go set up another one. And you're constantly going back and forth and back and forth. That's why you have to have your experiments set up ahead of time. In grad school, there is no such thing as open up a book, look at procedure, and go off and do it. Because you're inventing procedures. You're altering procedures. Even if you're following something step by step, you've got to put it in your lab notebook because that's a legal document. In the real world, you sign your lab notebooks. If there's a patent dispute, that lab notebook with your signature on it, confirming that you didn't falsify any of it, gets taken into court. And that's what can be the termination factor of whose patent is it really. I mean, that's just one example. But that's how lab books are treated at that level. So, in grad school, you would prepare everything ahead of time, and that's the way we're going to do it here. So for this first experiment, you will know if you did enough for your pre-lab, because when we come Thursday, you will not be allowed to look at your lab textbooks after I go through the pre-lab lecture. You can only do your experiment from your lab book itself, which if you turn to that first experiment, you read through, it's not that complicated. It's basically dissolve, mix, separate. So as long as you take the 15, 20 minutes it will probably take you to do this pre-lab assignment that I show you, you'll be fine. So don't get too worried, oh my God, is it going to kick me out of lab if I forget one word? No. I am going to check your pre-labs. The way we'll do roll for lab on Thursday is you'll come in, just put your lab book down here, I'll check through it, and I'll hand it back to you. If you don't have it done, you can, again, sit through the lab lecture, and then I'll send you home with a zero. But what do you have to do then for the lab? The pre-lab, for this first one, this is all you do. Probably still see where I wrote it yesterday. Have two columns, the way I recommend it at least. If you don't exactly follow this format, but you're doing the concept of what I'm asking for, that's fine too. Read through the procedure, which, here, let me pull the text out here, and I'll read you the first step. So page 161 has a few notes, such as, do not do this. Oh, diethyl ether. When it says extremely volatile, it's not kidding. There was another instructor that used to do this demonstration in another institution where he'd take just a little cap full of ether, pour it into the fume hood, turn off the fume hood system so it could just sit there in the fume hood, get a really long, long, long stick, one end of which was a match, and he would carefully put it into there so that you could see the blue fireball that the entire fume hood would become because that ether just expands out. And if a spark happens, that stuff is flammable. So believe it when you see it here. The two fires I've had in OChem Lab have happened because of ether. They didn't happen with this experiment, so don't get too panicked. But do pay attention to the safety notes. The first real procedure step is on top of page 162, where it says, obtain 2 grams of a mixture of benzoic acid and naphthalene. Dissolve the mixture by swirling it with 30 milliliters of diethyl ether in an Erlenmeyer flask. Since you probably know that if you dissolve something, you need to swirl it, you could simplify this and say, dissolve 2 grams benzoic acid and naphthalene in 30 mils ether in Erlenmeyer flask. That would be the first thing you write down. And then you just go through the other steps, and as you see them, write the steps down. That's it. Where it refers to techniques, don't worry about writing those techniques out. Read them, but only write the portion that's here on this page. So you only have this much text that you have to read through, and don't copy it word for word. Let your brain process it and then put it back down on paper. But this is it. So it's going to be a relatively short assignment. Leave yourself some data space so that when you measure something out, it says 2 grams, but you're not going to spend all day trying to measure 2.00 grams. Because if you do, the compound's going to sit there and lose or absorb water, and it's not going to be accurate anymore anyways. But whatever mass you do measure, you're just going to write that down. Or if something changes color, something changes to being cloudy or clear, your observations you can put down as well. So for your pre-lab, all you do, again, part A, write out like a laundry list, a grocery list of the steps that you're going to go through in that lab. And that's sufficient.